quite frankly, too long for your typical writing material in the ancient world. So the division is not here's part one and now here's the sequel, or 1 Samuel is not the prequel. We have one work that spans a significant time period, the lead up to the expectation for a king, the granting of a king, the disaster the first king was, the hopes that the second king will be better, and then we'd find out if that's true or not. And this is one unified work. So we're on into 2 Samuel now, and we think we're in chapter 3 this morning. One of the things that we saw in chapter 1 and chapter 2 of 2 Samuel is Joab seems to have quite a free hand under David. And Joab's interests may or may not align with David. Or at any rate, his execution of David's policies may not be what David had had in mind at various points. That's a question we left the text with last week. So we'll jump into chapter 3 in a bit. But Duane talked to us about presuppositions. While we're on that, presuppositions are very, very helpful, right? And these are the bedrock understandings of reality with which we approach everything we consider. One of our presuppositions as we approach Scripture is that it's trustworthy, right? And that it's true. But there are expectations that we build on that sometimes get in our way of actually reading the text that's in front of us, right? We know that David is a type of Christ, right? We know that Jesus is perfect, right? And although 1 Samuel, more 2 Samuel, will undo some of this for us, I think we have a tendency to flatten, especially the Old Testament text, when we read it in light of its fulfillment, or the antitype that we find in the New Testament. We'll miss the details because we're in a rush to get to Jesus, or we'll miss the complications of a character because we know that they're pointing us to someone who we know is good. Samson would be a classic example of that in the book of Judges, because he's mentioned in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews. Sometimes when we read Judges, we have a tendency to miss his foibles and miss the function that he fulfills in the book of Judges.
Yeah, I would say it's just more surprising to see him in Hebrews.
Yeah.
You know, when we're reading Judges, you know, for the most part, we're just thinking, what's wrong?
Yeah. You read Judges, and he, well, maybe we should do Judges next. We've done Judges a time or two, right? But, yeah. Samson embodies everything that's right, which isn't much, and everything that's wrong with Israel in the time period in which we find him. So, but let's look at David. Let's pay attention to what happens with David as we move through 2 Samuel. Right? 1 Samuel, he seems like a pretty good guy. And we know that he is pointing us to Jesus in various ways. But we're going to see also in 2 Samuel, I think, ways in which he points us to the fact that we need Jesus. David is not the king we need. David is perhaps a better king than we had, but he is not the king that we need. So let's jump in. Let's read 2 Samuel. Chapter 3. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. Right? It's frustrating to us. We know Saul's dead, and so we think now David's troubles are all over, right? And then Saul's heir is killed, and so, well, maybe now David's troubles are all over, and he can rule over a united Israel. But we had a hint in the previous chapter when he moves to Hebron, it tells us how long he reigned in Hebron versus how long he reigned. Right? And the implication is he does not yet reign over all Israel. I was in chapter 2, verse 11. In the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. So it's going to take a long time for things to sort themselves out. So there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel, and his second, Kileab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel, and the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur, and the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggi, and the fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital, and the sixth, Ithream of Eglon, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. What do you notice in those verses? He's got more wives. Like he had one, and then he ran away, and she was given to somebody else, and so he got another, and then another has been mentioned too. And now, here, it seems like each of these six sons who's born is born to a different woman. That's interesting. What do we make of that? Well, he, or his wives do anyway, right?
What was that?
His wives do anyway, right? He has his work cut out for him, or? Absalom's third born. Or third mentioned, yeah. Oh, that does, yeah. It names them with ordinal numbers. So Amnon is firstborn. That'll be important later. Then Ahinoam, who I don't think we hear much about after this. Then Absalom and Adonijah, whom we do. So watch for the names of his sons later. What often in the Old Testament it will stop to talk about the number of children someone is having. Right? Why would it do that? Mm-hmm. It's a sign of prosperity. It's a sign of blessing. We see this in the patriarchal narratives. As the patriarchs have so few children, it will mention their cousins who are flourishing. We have lots and lots of children. And there's this contrast that highlights the struggle of faith, the struggle of trusting God's promises through those years. But what about when Scripture mentions multiple wives? What usually goes along with that? I heard it from a couple of people. Yeah, trouble, strife, difficulty in the household. I'm just... Everybody probably feels that way. I worry about that when I'm preaching and I'll make application. I'll say, and to you, and to you, and to you. And then most people are like, mm-hmm. And then everybody's, every once in a while, somebody's eyes get really big.
I really remember teaching a children's church and mentioning multiple wives. And I said, and what do you think you get from that? And I was going for lots of kids. And one of the kids just goes, trouble.
It just mentioned sons. And they mentioned the son from each of different wives as opposed to just
yeah.
Children are the sons of each one. We're doing a little something different here.
Yeah. Because this is, right, we've seen reports of children before, we've seen reports of multiple wives before, but here, each son is assigned to a different wife, and that's highlighted. And other sons or daughters that may be born from those wives are not mentioned.
The other thing is, wives are sons and not daughters.
Yeah. Well, perhaps because we're concerned with dynasty. And the hope of kingship passing from David to his heir. But
would it be possible to claim claims of I am rightful heir?
Yeah. So one of these is firstborn to David, but each of these appears to be firstborn to a particular union of David's, some of which are from royal backgrounds. It's mentioned one was the daughter of the king of Geshur. So there are all kinds of overtones of like blessing, certainly, but also the anticipation of trouble and political struggle as well. Rose.
So Amnon, obviously, Amnon's going to be killed by Absalom. Chiliad, I looked it up on like an app, and it looks like he's never mentioned again. And then Absalom is, it was just said, the son of Maacha, daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. So he's got royal blood on that side. Mm-hmm. So is that why?
And he's definitely going to come up again.
Right, so is that part of what he thinks is his claim to like pass Chiliad?
Yeah, there's more to it as well in the relationship between Absalom and Amnon.
Well, right. I mean, he kills Amnon, but...
Yeah, yeah.
But Chiliad is still before him, like in terms of birth order, it looks like. So does he feel like he can just pass him because he's got this royal blood on the other side? Or?
We don't know. We don't know. Because we don't get more information about Chiliad.
Don't we only know of one daughter?
Yeah, surely he had others, but only one in particular is mentioned, Tamar.
Yeah. So. Tamar's like a pretty popular name with like the Israelites. Like, they make an instance.
Yeah. Well, and it's not even three, right? At this point, it's Abigail and Maacha and Haggith and Abital and Eglah and
so,
Michael.
So, we have to remember this is part of the Israel history. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we're going to expect to do is interpret these stories in the light of the law. And Israel's
Deuteronomy 17 is so we all know that we're supposed to read Deuteronomy 17 very closely when we start reading about Solomon, right? When we get to 1 Kings. But Deuteronomy 17 is every bit as much in the background for the narratives of Saul and David. Right? What does a good king look like? What do we expect, right? And this is in the background even earlier in Samuel, right? Israel wants a king, and Samuel's offended, and we talked about that when we year ago or more, right, when we were in 1 Samuel 8. Gee, that was a while ago. Right, that God had anticipated giving them a king and laid out specific things. So it wasn't their desire for a king per se. It was wrong. It was all of the other things that went with it. The kind of king they wanted. Why they wanted a king. Their failure to recognize Yahweh as their king in the midst of their asking for it. But that chapter continues to matter as we read about the kings that they get and the things that they do. And as Mike is pointing out, it's in the background here where suddenly, right, David doesn't just have two wives. He has five, having had another before, whom he's going to ask for again and take back. So much there. One of the best things you can do to come to understand the Bible more is read it. And read it again. read it again. And then read it again. How many people have you met and have a favorite movie? And they've watched it hundreds of times. How many of you like The Princess Bride? Right? I like The Princess Bride. Some of you don't, probably. I do, and I've watched it dozens of times. And if you give me a line, I can probably reply with the next line, right? Star Wars. Many of us thoroughly enjoy Star Wars, and we notice new things every time. Rewatching it with my kids this winter, I've noticed actually there's so much Roman history in the prequels. It allows me to look past Jar Jar Binks and and enjoy them so much more, right? Because the fall of the Republic and the rise of the Empire is all over these three movies, despite the horrible dialogue. But we
great sitcom by Andy Griffith.
And there's even a but we know this about our favorite movies, about our favorite books, about our favorite television shows, that even when we feel like we know them like the back of our hand, we can watch them again and see things we didn't before, or gain a new appreciation, or think about when they aired and look at the relationship between what was going on in the world and what was happening in the plot of the series. So many of the network series that aired following 9/11 are wrestling with the war of terror, maybe in a different galaxy, but in a way that's really eye-opening. But then we come to Scripture, and so many of us are like this. We'll, you know, this will be the year, I'll read through the whole Bible in a year, and now, you know, it took me a year and a half, but I did it, and I'm done. Right? I've done that. I've gotten what I need out of it because I've read the whole Bible through cover to cover. And we don't realize that there's so much richness that's there. This is part of what Spurgeon means when he describes the Bible as a book that grows with you. Because there's always more to see. There are always more connections to make. There are things that I am seeing, having read the former prophets several times, having taught it to graduate students, that reading it here on Sunday mornings with you, there are things that I am seeing for the first time. There is so much here. It's so amazing. So, but one of the things to do is not just to read whole books over and over again, but to think about other parts of Scripture as you read. What are some key chapters, right? And if we're reading anything that has anything to do with the idea of kingship, Deuteronomy 17 is the chapter that lays out the law for what kind of king Israel should have, how he should behave, and what they should expect of him. That would be a key chapter for all of these chapters, and for reading the Gospels, actually. We're going to think about Jesus as the Messiah, one who realizes this role of king. How does he fit these things that are outlined in Deuteronomy 17. So, David's already blown it, right? In ways that aren't necessarily flagged for us the last few times we read this. But lo and behold, he's got five wives, and he's not even king over Israel yet. Verse 6, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now, this was Saul's military commander, and Joab is David's military commander. They're both military commanders. They're both in charge of lots of people. And I have found, especially because they both have two-syllable names that have Ab in there somewhere, that I'm able to get them confused. So Joab is with Judah, and that may help. Abner was the house of Saul, and Joab is with the house of David. So Abner's making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, and to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. And Ish-bosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. What's going on in that interchange?
You're asking a completely different question.
Yes.
So it's Deuteronomy in view in terms of David. Maybe you covered this weeks ago and I missed it, but is it significant that in Deuteronomy 23:2 we're told that no one who is born of a forbidden union may enter the assembly of the Lord even to the 10th generation? None of his descendants may be the assembly of the Lord. David is 10 generations from the union of Tamar and Judah, which was illegitimate for.
That's so really helpful. Really nice. So
David is the first of the line of Judah who would be, since Judah's other sons were killed, wouldn't he be the first of part of the first generation that might be eligible to be fully part of the assembly?
Although he's also the grandson or great grandson of a Moabite?
Right, that's not the same as an illegitimate birth.
So Deuteronomy 23 prohibits the children of an illegitimate union up to the 10th generation from entering the assembly of the Lord. And David comes at a point where he can. That's interesting.
Because Matthew, looking at the genealogy of Matthew, David's 10th generation.
Yeah, looking at the genealogy of Matthew, which are highly stylized, but significant. Yeah. Yeah, David would be able to come. I had never thought about that. I have wondered often about David's relationship with the Moabites in light of Ruth, and then hiding his parents with the Moabites, and then later coming and decimating the Moabites. But
sorry, very much.
No worries.
I didn't know if we were supposed to that's how we're supposed
to be confused. I don't know. See, if we were in my Latin class during the week, and a student had asked a question like that, I would have said, well, you can find out and tell us on Wednesday, and I'll give you house points. We don't do house points for Sunday school.
The classic teacher's
answer. Yeah. It's great, because then I don't even have to remember that I told them I'd do that. They'll either do it or they won't. This exchange, we'll see if we can bring it back. This exchange between Abner and Ish-bosheth is not about the concubine.
Is it?
It's not about the concubine. I don't think we have any kind of modern parallel that helps us understand the undertones of what's going on. Because we have, on the whole, peaceful transitions of power. Yes, that's what's going on. So it's not about the concubine. It is about the fact that it's Saul's concubine. Right? When a new king comes to power by something other than dynastic succession, one of their symbols of, hey, I'm the king now, is they take all of the former king's wives. In addition to their own. As if to say, right, I'm more of a man than the king that you had. And I've conquered him and taken what's his.
And this was rooted in this story in Genesis, mm-hmm. Reuben going up and
So when Reuben takes his father's concubine in Genesis, that is
starting his
He's the firstborn. And then he goes and does that. And that is an assertion of power. Every bit as much as it's a inappropriate sexual encounter. It's much more about power and politics.
It's interesting, though, because you never get the real impression that Abner is trying to, you know, take over for himself.
But it's coupled with Ishbosheth certainly seems to think so.
Yeah.
And it's coupled with this note by the narrator that Abner is making himself strong in the house of Saul.
Yeah.
So is this...
But he doesn't seem to want to go to war with David. He seems to want to turn it over.
Yeah. He doesn't seem to want to go to war with David. Up to this point, he doesn't seem to have particular strife with Ishbosheth either. And it may be that on Abner's part, it's an unfortunate indiscretion that paired with his position causes this suspicion on Ishbosheth's part. But from where Ishbosheth is standing, there are all of these overtones to what's going on. You have a powerful military commander, someone in a position like David, who is now king over Judah in place of Saul. And Abner presents that kind of threat to Ishbosheth. And that, I think, helps explain to us Ishbosheth's response. And then also some of Abner's response to Ishbosheth.
Yeah, why would Abner get so upset with him? If...
I think Abner's, again, you know, we don't want to make it wooden, but Abner's generally a positive character in the narrative. And so I think it's likely that he didn't do anything, but what this is indicative of is I think two things. One is, an insecurity and a deficiency in the life of Saul, as represented by the official chef. He's kind of a characteristic like Saul. Saul
yeah.
is very insecure and protective of his power. And then, you know, so Ishbosheth is like that. So it's one, it's an indication he didn't need to be killed. And then another, the other thing is I think that it's an indication that God is providentially using incidents to move things forward in fulfillment of his promise. And they came. And so even though some would say, well, here's a, if you're reading this, some would say, well Ishbosheth, though, he is the rightful successor. But the narrative is pointing you toward, well, no, he really should be king. And so here's an indication, and here's a circumstantial coincidence
yeah.
that causes something, you know, one of the major obstacles to David.
Yeah. Ishbosheth is so much like his father.
Abner goes over to
yeah.
You know, Abner doesn't seem to think Ishbosheth is justified in his indignation.
No.
Because I mean Abner's just really indignant about his, you know, Ishbosheth's reaction.
Yeah.
And unlike his father, Saul would have been trying to kill Abner. Ishbosheth just like wouldn't go to his thing.
God's providence overseeing the nation of Israel as a whole. And it's also, I think, a revealing little window on God's providence. Because I think, perhaps not in this narrative, but at other times, we're tempted to look at situations like the one Ishbosheth finds himself in and think that, well, you know, it's his dad who blew it. So why is he going to lose the kingdom? God's not fair. Right?
His name in Chronicles is Ishbael, right?
Yes.
Ethal. And so Is he
Masterman?
Is he like? Is that perhaps like Saul having kind of and nodding his head at Baal when he named the son, and maybe that could that play into?
I don't think so. For a couple of reasons. One is that Baal is a common element of names at this time, and it's just a word for master or husband, as well as a proper name for Baal. But also, I don't feel like we get, right, at several points in Samuel, we get hints of a really, really rocky relationship between Saul and Yahweh, right? But I never have noticed anything in that that suggests a coloring that Saul is tempted to Baal worship so much as that just Saul doesn't care much about Yahweh worship except when he's able to use it to his own advantage. So Ishbosheth, not cut out to be king anyway. So verse 12. And Abner sent messages to David on his behalf, saying, "To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you." And he said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her, all the way to Bahurim. And Abner said to him, "Go, return." And he returned. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, "For some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then bring it about. For the Lord has promised David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'" Abner also spoke to Benjamin. Then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. What do you notice there? Ishbosheth does, yeah. Which suggests a few things, right? Because David's marriage to Michal is entangled with the idea of dynasty as well. Right? We know the answer from reading Samuel at other times, but until we reach a certain point in the book of Samuel, we continue to wonder if there's going to be the possibility of a continuing dynasty for Saul, even through David's line. I'm curious why, right, David asks here, and among other things, it gives Abner cover to do what he's doing. But why didn't David ask earlier? And why is Ishbosheth so willing? Is he trying to avoid war by granting that request? Because it's not, he can't ignore the request and avoid significant political turmoil. He can neither avoid nor grant the request and avoid significant political turmoil and the possibility of war. So. Another thing that I think is interesting here, and I think it's for a couple of reasons, is we're used to Judah and Israel being discussed separately. But here, Benjamin is separated from Israel, as though the entire rest of the nation of Israel has been ready for a long time to have David as king over them. But Abner knows, in particular because Saul is from Benjamin, that the tribe of Benjamin is going to need special attention to bring them around to this idea. We're not going to finish the chapter today. It is 9:59. So, read the rest of the chapter between now and next Sunday. You might reread a couple chapters before as well. We're going to have another situation where somebody thinks that they're bringing David the best news possible, and they're not going to get the response they expected. I'll leave you with that. Thank you.